Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sustainable Future Series, The Future of Healthcare with Lachlan Toward, Jean Neme, Dr. Susan Murray, and our UBS host, Michaela Simon. I am Shari, the Chorus Call operator. The conference must not be recorded for publication or broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand over to UBS Sustainable Investing Strategist, Michaela Simon. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Shari. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our new Sustainable Future Series 2020. Over the coming months, we will present to you various topics at the core of sustainable investing and with the insights of global experts. We are delighted that you are joining us today for this very topical and fascinating theme, the future of healthcare. My name is Michaela Simon Howard, and I'm a sustainable and impact investing strategist and the Chief Investment Office of UBS Global Wealth Management. I'm your host for this call, and I'm honored to have three amazing speakers with me here today who will share with us their specific insights into today's topic. Earlier this month, our CIO team published research on our views regarding sustainable investing after COVID-19. We expect increased investor focus on environmental, social and governance considerations as a consequence of COVID-19 and as these factors increasingly affect financial performance. Specifically, we see an elevated importance of the social aspect for companies and investors. Amongst others, healthcare and access to medicines are in focus. I will now introduce all three speakers to you up front. Our first speaker today is Dr. Suzanne Murray. Dr. Murray created the Smithsonian's Global Health Program to investigate health and disease at the human-animal interface and train the next generation of conservationists. The factors that led to the current COVID-19 outbreak and preventing the next pandemic is the reason this program was created. Given that nearly 75% of human infectious diseases come from wildlife, Dr. Murray's team conducts wildlife health surveillance and build in-country capacity in countries in East Africa and Southeast Asia to save people and animals alike. Smithsonian's global health team, with other specialists addressing urgent wildlife needs by deploying rapid response team to global hotspots. The team's successes so far include the discovery of 5 novel coronaviruses in Myanmar, and they are part of a larger team that has discovered over 1,000 new mammalian viruses in the last 10 years. Dr. Murray also acts as the Smithsonian's liaison to the, unfortunately rather long named, Foreign Animal Disease Threat Subcommittee and Pandemic Preparedness Forecasting Subcommittees of the White House. Following Dr. Murray, Mr. Jean Neme from Touch Surgery will talk to us about something which is very dear to our hearts here at UBS, health tech and innovation. Plastic surgeon by training, Jean left clinical practice to find a solution to help deliver consistent surgeries at scale. His company helps health professionals measure and visualize exactly what is happening during operations with advanced computer vision, machine learning, data analytics, and education. Jean's experience is very valuable during this pandemic, as COVID-19 has laid bare the weaknesses in our various healthcare systems. The core of his business is built on data analytics. COVID-19 has shown that absence of data and core technologies create some of the main problems we experienced in our healthcare systems. Both Dr. Murray and Jean Neme are part of our Global Visionaries program here at UBS. Last but not least, my colleague in the CIO office and equity analyst, Lachlan Toward, will provide us with some insights to how we assess the current situation from an investment perspective and what opportunities we are focusing on. As our operator announced, following the talks, there will be a Q&A session based on questions from you, ladies and gentlemen, our valued audience. I would like to invite our first speaker today, Dr. Susan Murray, to share with us her story and thoughts on the current situation. Welcome, Dr. Murray.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a great honor and pleasure to be here. And thank you for the introduction. As you've noted, I'm the director of Smithsonian's Global Health Program, and we investigate health and disease at the human-animal interface, and we also work to save endangered species. COVID-19 is the reason that our program was started 5 years ago, based on the information that we knew that pandemics were coming and will be continuing to come, and we were trying to help put in place some of the things to get ahead of this. It's our program's built on the concept that recognizing that there's an inextricable link between human, animal, and environmental health, and even more so looking at the continuum of health amongst all species between humans and animals in particular. And if we're going to look at the survival of species, it's really important at this point that we approach it from a holistic approach, and we recognize that the health of one species or one animal affects, and the environment also affects human health. As we look towards the future of the global, for the future of healthcare here for UBS, it's often said that the best predictor of the future is the past. And if we combine that with our knowledge of the past with what's going on in the present, hopefully we can and have some honest and open conversations about what worked and what didn't without placing blame, but actually to just analyze the data and look at that to move forward. Hopefully we can be much better prepared for the next time, because we do know that it's coming. So what do we know about the past, and why do we create this program? We know that about 75% of emerging infectious diseases come from wildlife and then cross into the human population. We know this is called spillover. We know that spillover is most likely to occur at human-wildlife interfaces in countries with high biodiversity, but also high human population growth. We know the type of viruses that are most likely to cause a problem, and we know the species that are most likely to carry these viruses. If we had all the resources if resources were limitless, we would look at all animals in all countries. But if we're trying to prioritize, we really need to think about where are the countries and the communities most at risk for spillover, and which are the animals most likely to be involved in that, and then which are the viruses that are most likely to cause a problem. So we've known that bats, primates, and rodents are the animals that are most likely to cause a problem. And we also know that of all the viral families, some of the ones that are largest of concern are the influenza family, coronaviruses, filo, and paramyxoviruses. We also know that there's many factors that influence the spillover and secondary spread, meaning animal to person or person to person, and that many of these things, such as land use change, the illegal wildlife trade, and the ability to get on a plane and travel around the world, all these factors contribute. So we already know a lot, but our models, our predictive models, to understand when the next virus is going to erupt and how it's going to act when it once it has spilled over, our predictive models are really only as good as the data that we put in. So data is really important, and the more that we can find out about the viruses that are there and the interfaces, the more that we can affect a change. So in terms of where we are now, there's another common saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and obviously that's true on many levels. Preventing pandemics is obviously the morally and socially correct thing to do. We can save a lot of human lives and prevent a lot of human suffering. We can do this through many ways, through wildlife surveillance, pathogen discovery, real-time human and animal surveillance, and developing rapid response teams to the communities that are at the highest risk. If we do this, we can save hundreds of thousands of human lives, and which, again, that's obviously the most important part and where we should be concentrating. However, there is also a huge economic component, as we've all discovered. And it costs a lot of money to run surveillance and programs and gather the data. It will cost millions of dollars to prevent the next pandemic, but we've already seen it's going to cost trillions of dollars if we wait until the horse is out of the barn and that people are becoming ill and getting infected. So if we think of it that way, if we wait until people are ill and dying, and then we start looking into it, and then we start trying to build laboratory capacity, and then we start trying to figure out what virus it is, and then backtrack and from what animal did it come, and what did people do to put them in harm's way, we've lost months or a year, hundreds of thousands of human lives, and again, millions of dollars. So if we want to get ahead of this, we really need to move the look upstream a little bit. From my perspective, the CDC has been doing, and other organizations for human health are doing a very good job, as best job as they can, to monitor and address human health issues. But if we know that so many of these diseases come from wildlife first, it means it's a very obvious gap that we don't have an analogous organization that can do the same thing for animals and get ahead of everything. So what does the future look like? So we talked about the past and where we are now, where we have a virus that has spread everywhere. What can we do for the future? We know that no one can do everything, but everyone has a role. And I think this is one of the important parts. Everybody is, not everyone, but we often, as humans, look for what other people can do. In this situation, healthcare and responding to a pandemic and preventing the next one is all of our responsibilities. So everybody has a role, and I think we need to think of it in that way. There's a number of things that connect all of us around the globe, great things like the environment or cultures and food, and there's some things that connect all of us that we might not want to be connected by, like these things like viruses. But we also, it's time for us to recognize that we are indeed connected by these things, and there's a lot we can do to recognize that and prevent that. One of the most important things I would say that we've done a great job of looking at the economy on a global scale. We've recognized that for decades now, that the economies of one country affect the other. I think it's really time for us to look at health on that same scale and on a global level. So what's the answer? There's a number of different answers, and John will tell you just in a few minutes about the critical importance of data and core technologies, areas that we really, really need to expand upon. But the other underlying premise from my perspective is effective partnerships, that we all have a role to play, and there's many different partnerships that have already been developed or are being developed or need to be developed. And I mean like partnerships between organizations, between countries, partnerships between human and animal medicine, I think, is really critical for looking at global healthcare. Partnerships between public and private organizations. There's a lot of the important healthcare or research is being funded by through philanthropy and through grant work that really needs to continue. Obviously, partnerships that will support the human healthcare workers who are. Thank goodness for the human healthcare workers, because where would we be without them? Other partnerships between banking industries and philanthropies and investing in our frontline workers, whether they're those folks frontline in human healthcare today, or the field workers in our various countries who are training for wildlife surveillance. And then the other thing is, as we look forward to developing some of the, or utilizing some of our, the technologies that are available for us to use machine learning and have more of a real-time surveillance of both human and animal health, we need to think of the best way to gather this data and develop some of the, and respond to and develop some of the missing core technologies. So with that, I would like to hand off to my co-global visionary, and actually I should have started off by thanking UBS for the Global Visionary Program. I do think it's really important, and it brings all of us together, and this is an example when we think, well, what can banking industries do? There's a lot we can do, and this is one of the things, like bringing these important issues forward to investing firms. So with that, I'd like to hand off back to you, Michaela, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you so very much, Dr. Murray. That was fascinating. And indeed, as you just said, I mean, the last words you had is about the partnerships, and clearly partnerships is at the core of our sustainable investing theme. So a very critical topic here, and we realize the potentials and the needs we need to follow through. So thank you so very much, Dr. Murray, for your fascinating talk and insights into your work. The great relevance of it has been so apparent already before, but we all realize now, actually more and more, how much more work there is left to be done. So very good. And I'm excited to see all the questions coming in later on. So I will now hand over to our second speaker, Mr. Jean Némé from Touch Surgery. Jean, welcome. The line is yours.
Thank you very much for having me. And it's really exciting to do one of these virtual calls, but they're probably quite hard to do as well. As you can imagine, normally speaking to an audience that you can see is so much easier, but I'll give it a go. So for everyone just on the line, background is I trained in surgery and trained as a doctor, and ended up working in one of the world's largest healthcare systems, the National Health Service in the United Kingdom. And I guess no one was clapping for us or anyone back then, but being on the front line and delivering healthcare is pretty difficult. Whether you're a doctor or whether you're a nurse or, whether you're a carer of some form, healthcare delivery is really hard, right? And having trained as a doctor, you step in kind of day one onto the wards and into the hospital system, expected to know things. And what you realize is actually over time, it's pattern recognition, and it's the process of experience that allows you to become better, that allows you to understand when someone's unwell or sick, that allows you to know when a child comes in, if they're actually going to be okay, or if that's an appendicitis that they've got, right? And the first thing I want to try and emphasize to everyone on this call is, we all think of healthcare services, but when we seek healthcare as a service for ourselves, we're looking for somebody who has answers, we're looking for experience, and we're looking for understanding, right? Now, being a doctor, being a surgeon, I remember the first time I did an operation, the first time I tried to take out an appendix. And again, the process of, no matter how much you had studied for this, no matter how much your anatomy you're on top of, the process of actually doing medicine and performing it, again, incredibly hard. And as a surgeon, as somebody who was training in surgery, I realized that there was this huge variance in surgical process, and that medicine and surgery, were shifting from a place of craft, right, to a place of empirical data and evidence-based. And actually, what I wanted to do was think, is there a way that we could even shift healthcare and surgery more with data and computing? And so with a colleague of mine, Dr. Andre Chow, we started building a platform and coding, and we started essentially as a research project, trying to take surgical process and to structure surgical process as a data structure. I'll be very specific what I mean by this. If you imagine surgery as an example, of navigating, so you know, you all will recall how you get to work. You know, you go down this road, take a left, and then, you know, cross to this road and take a right. So surgery is very similar, and you can take processes in healthcare and break them down into fundamental steps. And so we started doing this about 5 years ago with a view of taking that data and structuring it in a way that would allow us to deliver a platform to support other colleagues for training. And so we launched an application called Touch Surgery, which is a training tool on your mobile, really around trying to take that experience, that knowledge that everybody else had, and trying to give it to your surgeon day one before they do that operation, and your doctor day one before they do anything medical, so that they can access that information on their phones. And then we started to try and teach computers to understand the same process, right? So same data, same thinking, but instead of just training surgeons, where we had, at that point in time, over 5 million users, we started to train computers. And again, same logic. If you think of the world of self-driving cars and the world of robotics, you know, computing is now able to determine and understand pattern. And if you remember to what I said at the beginning of this conversation, when you go and see someone in healthcare, you're looking for somebody who has strong pattern recognition. And so if you can train computers to have pattern recognition, then our thesis was soon you'll have computing power, which doesn't retire, and therefore all that knowledge won't leave the system, continue to remain, and therefore continue to deliver value beyond the years and gain value through the years. So, in summary, before I move on to the COVID part of this talk, in summary, you know, the thesis was, as a healthcare provider, as a surgeon, as somebody who was on the front line, thinking about healthcare as a process of delivery of a service, where that delivery of the service is better with more experience. I built this business, which ended up getting acquired by Medtronic about 18 weeks ago now, which was taking data, processing data, and using computing power to give back to support surgical process and to support surgical training, which was very exciting. Now, for a long time, I've been an advocate of healthcare infrastructure, right, and of healthcare thinking. And I think if we look at COVID and if you look at the incredible responses that you've seen, there are three things that I'd really like to raise. The first is no healthcare infrastructure in the world was ready to deal with pandemics, right? So the pandemic truly tested our investment into healthcare infrastructure. It tested our ability to scale healthcare services. And almost every country in the world had to figure out how to get more people to the front line, had to figure out how to find ventilators, how to figure out which medications could be used, how to share knowledge, right? And so the first thing that everybody should be aware of on an investment perspective is, you know, we haven't truly invested in healthcare infrastructure in a way where it scales, right? Unlike other services in the world where you can scale very quickly, especially services that are supported through computing and through robotic infrastructures, right? It's almost like scale is built into the services, but healthcare isn't built to deal with scale. That's point number one. Point number two is data is a core component to thinking about scale and thinking about processes. It is, again, something that was tested. And I'll give you a very simple example of this. Almost every different epidemiology department came up with different models. And one of the things we haven't really figured out with COVID was the denominator, right? Number of people who were truly infected. And I'm sure everybody in their household scrambled around trying to find a thermometer, right? Very simple piece of kit. But, you know, that ability to take somebody's temperature and to share it in a way with your healthcare system could have potentially identified temperature spikes and therefore allowed healthcare services to identify where there was high rates of COVID infections, right? Temperature, we know, and fever is one of the signs of being infected with COVID. And so again, data is a core component. Data acquisition, data processing, data computing is something that has to be built in and something that we should be investing into as we think about healthcare infrastructure and healthcare system. And then I guess the last point is, you know, what's been exciting is to hear from all the physicians, the scientists, and folks who have rushed to really help try and build response to the pandemic, who have really tried to go out and really try and solve for some of the needs. And why I'm excited about this is because, you know, I think there's been so much science that's been funded through grants and funded through research for a long period of time. And I think that this new opportunity where investors and folks like, you know, the folks on this call, where you guys get to see some of that, you know, deep science that could really transform how we deal with a hot condition right now, which is this virus, but actually beyond that, how we can transform different parts of healthcare, whether it's, you know, treatments of cancer or treatments of mental health conditions or computing. You know, there's going to be a stronger collaborative effort, I think, between private funding, between institutional government funding, and between scientists who are building incredible technologies. So with that said, I'm incredibly excited about the next decade of healthcare technology, healthcare infrastructure, and really incredibly excited to be part of the conversation. So thank you, UBS, and over back to you.
Lovely. Thank you so very much for sharing with us the views from an insider at the healthcare system, Jean. I mean, this was a very honest take up here. Interesting also that you shared you mentioned sharing knowledge. So again, the theme or the call for a partnership is at the core of what you talked about. I mean, as we just heard from Dr. Murray and John Nimi, COVID-19 has been a challenge for our healthcare systems and society. However, this challenge should provide a positive change that is permanent and could most likely be also supported by newly established regulatory frameworks, providing a new status quo. So this is hopefully what we can hope see coming forward. I would like to invite now our third speaker and my colleague Lahan Towat to provide us with some insights into our thinking process here at UBS and how we can respond to the current challenges with specific investment opportunities. Lahan, welcome.
Thanks, Michaela. And let me also extend my thanks to our two speakers who have, I think, really brought out a number of the takeaways from the pandemic and also both mentioned explicitly something that I'm very interested in, which is the growing importance of data in healthcare. So I'll come back to that. But first, to your point, Michaela, is really to tackle the question of how do we think about the future of healthcare at UBS? And one of the things we are trying to do is, of course, we have new learnings from the pandemic, but we're trying to integrate those into our previous beliefs about how healthcare is evolving. And we had already laid out several trends that we've been observing for a few years. And the use of technology is one of these trends, and we think it will be accelerated. But there are other patterns maybe in healthcare development, healthcare services that will be less affected, but the overall impact, I think, on the sector is almost entirely positive. There will be more investment, as was just talked about. People understand more what healthcare companies can do, what the biotech industry can do for everybody. So that's a little bit of background. Now, what we've been saying for some time is that we think healthcare is an industry that has been slow to adopt digitalization, but as a result has enormous potential to catch up. And we heard some of those examples already from Jean Nemé. So we estimate that 5% of the data in the world is actually generated in the healthcare industry, but the problem is that it's not been used very efficiently. A lot of the time that data sits in silos. One part of a hospital doesn't realize that another part of a hospital has data that could be relevant to how it treats an individual patient or maybe how it goes about treating an entire group of patients. But we think increasingly healthcare companies are cottoning onto this. We see it in the pharma industry, who started to bring people in from the tech industry. We see it in medtech companies who incorporate more digital communication in their products. We see it in the way that healthcare providers are offering service, and we even see it in managed care in the US. The other thing you see, of course, is you see tech companies looking to get involved in the healthcare industry themselves. So they've seen the opportunity. So this is a very clear trend. And as we've been talking about, it has been accelerated by the pandemic. I also wanted to pick up on a couple of other trends that are related, but I think are sometimes overlooked, but definitely linked to digitalization. The first is what we call consumerization, so the patient as a consumer. And the second is value, or value for money more specifically. So consumerization is something that to some extent was pushed onto patients by insurers that are trying to make the patients more cost conscious. But actually it turns out that with technology and with more and more access to information, patients are able to take a greater interest in their health. And I think this is something that will be a, you know, this is something that patients will continue to do. And it's going to be important because in the future, we think that people are going to have to take more, not just a financial commitment to their health, and take more interest, but really be more active in keeping themselves healthy. Healthcare is going to become more about prevention than it is at the moment. Something like 3% of the total health budget is spent on prevention. And frankly, that's not enough. So this consumerization is going to continue as a trend. And then I think value is fairly self-explanatory. As we spend more money on healthcare, we need to spend that money more wisely. We need to cut out waste, avoid unnecessary treatments, and really focus our money, focus our budgets on where they can have the most effect. This is beginning to manifest itself in new ways where providers are paid for delivering results rather than, for example, delivering a volume of service. And I think this is a good thing as well. What both of these trends have in common is you need data to make them work. Okay, so you need what we call health tech. And this is going to be more and more important in a world where, you know, as Dr. Murray and as John Neme highlighted, the pandemic means there will be more demand for investment in healthcare. Jean made it very clear that healthcare systems were underprepared for the pandemic. So there's going to be a demand for more spending. There's going to be a demand for more stockpiles, more capacity. And of course, as Dr. Murray highlighted, all of these things cost money. That money may come from governments, but some of it will probably also have to come from private capital. So now I want to move on and I want to talk about three themes that we think are very exciting. These are all part of what we refer to as longer term investment themes, where the underlying dynamics that really drive the themes are some of the demographic trends we see, but also they revolve around social changes. And in the case of healthcare, they revolve around also a lot of the application of technology. So really the question now is, okay, well, this is how do I invest in the future of healthcare? So the first one is what we call health tech. And as I mentioned, COVID has really been a trigger that's led to a surge of interest in this theme more broadly, also more specifically in telemedicine or remote treatment. But let me step back a little bit and talk about why we like this from an investment perspective. And for us, the idea of using technology here is that you can make healthcare more efficient. So I mentioned a little bit about how budgets are going to be under pressure. We need to bring costs down while improving outcomes. And that in a world where demand is going to keep rising, but budgets are essentially constrained, that's something that's going to be, I think, a real driver of this this theme over the longer term. In the US, as I alluded to, perhaps even especially in the US, we have seen health insurers trying to get more out of their insured patients by essentially pushing more and more of the cost back to patients. High deductible health plans, higher co-pays, especially on drugs, which has really become a political topic in the last couple of years. And I think that's gone about as far as it can go. So the takeaway here is really that all of the focus is on the cost of drugs. The drugs are only 15% of the cost of healthcare. So if you want to tackle health costs, you actually have to tackle inefficiency elsewhere in the system as much as or even more than you have to tackle the price of drugs. So just a few examples of what's involved in the health tech theme. Telemedicine, but also minimally invasive surgery, miniaturization. These are ways that you can shorten recovery times. If you have a less invasive surgery, you're going to get people out of the hospital sooner, and as Jean-Némé alluded to as well, at more reproducible outcomes. And of course, this brings down costs. Wearable devices, I think these devices are going to become more medical rather than consumer products over time. This means that doctors can have a much better data set to work with. You don't have to take a measurement from me once a month in a 10-minute appointment, but you actually have a series of data points from over time, especially when I'm less focused on the intrusive nature maybe of having the test done. So these are all, you know, opportunities within health tech. And the other great thing to mention about health tech is you're contributing to improving access to healthcare as well. The second trend would be genetic therapies. And this is really a theme about new technology in and understanding of the human genome and the immune system that's happened over the last two decades since the sequencing of the genome. You can see a bit of this in the progress and the speed at which the biotech and pharma industry has responded to the pandemic. We had the sequence of the SARS-CoV-2 virus was produced very, very quickly. And we've also seen rapid accelerated development of, so far, several vaccine candidates, many of which are using RNA technology that didn't exist 10 years ago. So this is the tools that underpin this, our genetic therapies theme. And in brief, the idea of these therapies is that we now have technology that allows us to go in and modify the genetic information in the patient's cells and go right into the DNA with gene therapy and potentially one day a more complex method called gene editing. This means we can address the underlying causes of disease, and that's really different from how you treat a lot of things now. If you think of the pills we take today, these are really only treating symptoms. They're not getting at the underlying causes. So this is something that really could be transformational. So far, it's relatively niche, being used in rare inherited diseases. But if we could see some of these results replicated in more common conditions, this is something that can really be genuinely disruptive, transformational for how the drugs industry work. So it's interesting to us now because it's at that tipping point where it's moving from research into commercial reality. And I think you'll see more of these gene therapy treatments approved later this year and next year. There's a hemophilia treatment that could come to market already in the summer of this year. So I think there'll be continued news flow here. And the other thing to highlight is that the big pharma companies are paying attention. They've already invested about $40 billion into these treatments. And if they continue to be successful, I think they'll be investing more money. And that, of course, will include potentially having to consider buying the startup companies that have already done a lot of the work. And the last thing I'll mention, and I'll mention it briefly because we already covered it this morning on a live stream, was the oncology theme. So some of these technology developments I've been talking about, and hopefully more people taking control of their own health, will mean with a greater focus on prevention, we could have a lower burden of chronic disease in future. But the one thing I think we won't be able to get away from is the growing incidence of aging. And the big ones here are going to be cancer and dementia. So with cancer, we expect that the number of new cancer cases diagnosed will grow every year for the next two decades or so at approximately double the rate of population growth. And this is supporting a large market, around 15% of the global drugs market, that will also continue to outgrow relatively relative to the broader drugs market. It's very investable. You can invest in large cap pharma companies. These are good stable stocks to own, good sources of dividend income. Or you can take a more high risk, high reward approach, looking at smaller biotech companies that are much closer, much more geared to the clinical development and the successful development of those drugs. So with around a third of global drug pipelines focused on oncology, we think that a portfolio of these oncology stocks is a really good way to get exposure to what is likely to remain one of the fastest growing parts of the global drugs market. So that's a little bit of a quick tour around some of the areas that we think are interesting. Michaela, I would like to pass it back to you, but let me just sum up by saying that for us, the future of healthcare is going to see, number one, more capacity, more investment. Number two, more use of technology and a more involved patient. And number three, hopefully a more holistic approach to health that will produce better outcomes at a reasonable cost. And we have approaches to tackle each of those trends. Michaela.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Lachlan. It is so exciting to see that there are already so many interesting and promising investment opportunities available, actually. For sure, this is a sector we will continuously follow and monitor. Okay, be briefed on that. Now, I would like to invite you, ladies and gentlemen, to ask your questions to our speakers. And with that, I will hand over directly to our operator, Shari. Could you please kindly take over for the Q&A? While we're waiting, actually, for questions, I would actually already have something to ask Dr. Murray and Jean, maybe. How do you see the telemed playing a role in the future? Lachlan was just talking about it extensively from our themes, but how are you thinking about this in your respective fields? Maybe Dr. Murray wants to start on this.
Yes, thank you. I'd love to start on that. And I think both Lachlan and Jean had mentioned it, and I had meant to discuss that as well. I think that telemedicine is most definitely a way of the future, and we're already, and human medicine has been incorporating that, and increasingly we are, that's one of the things that we are beginning to work with a lot in veterinary medicine. If we want to try and catch some of these illnesses in the field before it spreads to people, this isn't really an ideal way. And also looking at syndromic surveillance, both in animals and humans at the same time in the same location, is really going to be key for us. So I think this is a brilliant area for us to be looking at and investing in. John, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, better connectivity and better access to healthcare is important. And, telehealth is starting to really help provide that kind of better access, better experience. I think there's a lot of work to do on the different technology stacks. It's nice to see that, there's been obviously an increased rate of adoption. And I'm sure for people who are following public markets, so you can, one of the stocks, one of the companies, Teladoc, has done incredibly well, kind of just through demonstrating like an increased rate of adoption. So, do I want to be able to call a primary care physician and not have to, go and wait and physically sit in a department until I really have to? Yeah, absolutely. And, do we have the complete solution yet? Not quite, but I think there's going to be some exciting work in this space.
Okay. Shari, I think we have some questions in the line. Would you like to take over, please?
The first question comes from questioner number one. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the really very interesting report and discussion. Actually, the also one very important topic is the standard operation procedure, international one and national one, which will prevent the rising of the global pandemic. And this standard operation procedure, or let me say international or national legislation, will allow in very quick manner do all the necessary steps to prevent expanding of pandemic. What is your opinion about that? Hello?
Yeah, we did hear you. Thank you so very much for the question. It's indeed a very relevant topic altogether, and I mentioned it also that regulation will play a key role here. Maybe Dr. Murray, this is something for you, because you're working obviously in various countries, and how does it pan out for you?
Michaela, would you be able to repeat part of the question? It cut out for me.
I mean, we are talking about the prevention, we are talking about the treatment, but we also have to think about prevention of the expanding of pandemic so quick and so dramatic, on the so dramatic way. That's why, what about the harmonization of the standard operation procedure during that size of pandemic issue when it's happening via coronavirus?
So,
Dr. Murray, did you?
If I'm understanding correctly, we're thinking of harmonizing and coordinating some of our organizations, right? Is that it? More across countries to prevent the next pandemic?
Indeed, it is, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that's actually really key. And within, so many organizations have a different approach, and so many countries have a different approach. So I think that's one of the things that we really need to work on. It's an opportunity for growth for us to build these partnerships, recognize some of the gaps, and then bring them forward. So coordination and harmonization between different countries and developing the SOPs. So what do we do? What do we do to prevent the pandemic? What data do we need? How is that organized? And are we all following the same script? that's one of the things that we've been fortunate in the past to work on through some USAID-funded programs. We're hoping for, I think there are a lot of organizations who are working to do that, but again, funding is often an issue. I will say that one other thing that we were talking about as we're trying to prepare is to have a better understanding of what viruses are there now. And there is a new organization that was just became a nonprofit called the Global Virum Project, which is looking to help characterize the over 1 million as yet undiscovered viruses. So I think that might be key in helping to develop SOPs between countries. That and also organizations that are really working specifically to work across country boundaries. I think that's also what we're going to a little bit in the talk earlier, that the more we start thinking of health globally and the more we start bringing up health on conversations like this, the better.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Have more questions in the queue, operator.
The next question comes from the questioner number 2. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks to all the speakers for excellent presentations. My question relates to the trends that Lachlan highlighted in terms of value for money and where the investment's going to go in healthcare moving forward. And I'd be interested in his thoughts on whether we see this as a lose-lose for pharma in the midterm. Lose in terms of they're already facing increasing scrutiny on pricing. Somebody's got to pay for the implications of this virus. It's a very obvious target moving forward in terms of the visibility around the budget, and lose in terms of the reallocation of resources around healthcare spend as we move more to service provision as opposed to increasing the expenditure on drugs as well. So be interested in perspectives on that.
Okay, sure. I'll have a go at some of that. It is an excellent question, and I think I can see a world in which that does become a problem, but I don't think that that's going to be the most likely outcome. So let me address a couple of issues. First of all, the pharma industry was not a popular industry 12 months ago. It's not been a very popular industry for the past 5 years. And as I tried to allude to at the beginning of my talk, that sort of changed. People now do realize that the drugs companies can do good things. Now, we don't have much yet in the way of tangible developed treatments for COVID. We don't have a vaccine yet. But people realize that the drugs companies are working on it. So hopefully we get something. 6 months ago or a year ago, the dialogue is entirely about how much drug companies wanted to charge for products. And, you know, it's easy to focus on the high gross margins. It's easy to focus on the absolute dollar cost of a pill. But remember that the vast majority of drugs don't make it to market. And once you adjust for capitalized R&D, the return on investment in the pharma industry isn't actually as high as people think. So the financials of the industry are not what a lot of people actually perceive them to be. Now, that's a perception problem. It's not a reality problem. So I think when you say, okay, a year ago we were in this position where everyone thought the drugs industry could do no good, could only do harm, now a lot of people have changed their mind. Now, if you think about the political angle, politicians clearly react to what their voters are interested in, and that's why you've seen pressure on the drugs industry. I'm talking mostly about the US here. You've seen pressure on the drugs industry to lower drug prices. It's actually not the case that drug prices have come down, by the way. Drug prices have gone up more slowly, and the headline prices have sometimes come down slightly. But the actual net price that the drug companies get has stayed broadly flat on a like-for-like basis over the past few years. So the industry has managed this, and it's managed to absorb this pressure. And I do think there will be continued noise out of Washington, but it'll be more bark than bite, because the realities of what goes on in D.C. mean that it's very, very difficult to pass the kind of legislation that would be needed to change significantly the way that pharma companies are paid. So long story short, I think that the pricing pressure has already been seen, and it's resulted in a diminished pricing pressure, diminished pricing power for the industry, but that we will not see an actual outright deflationary environment for the drugs industry. Meanwhile, some of the pressure has come off a little bit. We can, you know, you can have a separate debate about what happens politically a few years down the line, but I think in the short term, there's unlikely to be a major change to the situation. Does that get to your questions?
Yeah, thank you.
But I do take your point that it's a very visible element of healthcare spend, because people have to pay hard dollars when they go to the pharmacy counter, which you normally don't when you go into the hospital for an operation. So I think that's a very well taken point, and it remains a risk.
Thank you, Lachlan. We have a third question in the line, operator. Sherry?
The next question comes from the line of questioner number 3. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. I actually have an initial observation and then a question which is an investment question, if you will. So in terms of the observation, the speakers have mentioned how every country or most countries were totally caught by surprise in terms of the infrastructure necessary to combat this pandemia. And I must say that I wasn't surprised at all by the fact of the lack of infrastructure, okay? Because this is the way hospitals and perhaps the health system works, okay? So we've learned obviously a lesson. But I was surprised instead on how even very basic information was not provided. And therefore there is an issue of real basic information. Let me give you two examples. One, for a great period of time initially, people were not told and were not aware of what they could do with a simple mask. And what was the differences between masks? What function does a mask do for you or for the others? It took a long time, and even today, there are significant doubts as to whether, you know, what does a mask really do for you? And the second, if you will, also basic information or observation is, if you ask somebody, you know, what is the probability of you contracting coronavirus from droplets in the air, and what is the probability of you contracting coronavirus by touching something and then putting your hands in your mouth or in your, most probably in your eyes? Even today, most people don't know what the answer is, what the percentage probability is. So my first observation is really, you know, how bad can it get in terms of providing basic information? Okay. The second question instead, which has an investment element into it, is if I were here to tell you that I'm working very advanced, you know, in finding the vaccine that can help sort of, eliminate or help, face the problem of coronavirus. Obviously, from a pure investment perspective, everybody would be very interested. I would have, you know, I could pick and choose what channel news in the world I would sort of use to inform that the fact that the vaccine has been found, and there would be a lot of A, interest, and B, a lot of value proposition in what has been found. Okay, now I happen to be working on something different, and the question is, would in your mind this be more important or less important of a vaccine? And what I'm working on with scientists, obviously, is a technology that helps prevent the spread of the virus. And it basically answers to the simple question: today, people are not going to be going on an airplane. They're not going to be going on a cruise. And most probably, they also have a hard time going to a hospital, because they're very concerned that they may go into a hospital with one problem and they come out with another problem. And that is because the sanitary conditions of the hospital, of the plane, or the crews are very sort of potentially infectious. Okay, so the technology that I'm working on is a technology which allows for the hospital, for the plane, and for the crews, just to give you an example, or for a shop, to be significantly more secure in terms of, you know, eliminating the presence of viruses. And I repeat, viruses, not coronavirus, any virus, okay? And the difficulty is to kill a virus. Killing a virus is far more difficult than most people can imagine. And therefore, the technology, which is the laser-based technology, does exactly that, okay? And so far, it's proving extremely effective. So the question is, if I were here to say that the technology that I have eliminates or at least reduces very considerably the risk of being infected in an environment where there is the most likelihood of contagions, i.e. with other people, would you consider this as important or less important or more important than having found a vaccine for the coronavirus? Thank you.
Thank you very much for these questions. Very interesting indeed, and very valuable. If I may, probably the first part of your question. So, how bad can it get to get actually the basic information? It's again a little bit linking in what Dr. Murray said. So maybe I let Dr. Murray ask the first part of the question: how best to coordinate information and how to make sure that everybody gets this information? Because a lot of it, because you mentioned the impact of masks and the probability to contract the coronavirus, a lot of it was given by the World Health Organization as a general unit. And then the second one with regard to the investment, maybe Jean can comment on this. So Dr. Murray, do you want to take the first one, please?
Yes, sure. I'll start with that. I also like the idea the person asking the question brought up about the concept of surprise, like who was surprised and who wasn't, because I feel that that's something for us to think about, that a lot of the people in healthcare and finance and economics and business, well, were indeed surprised at this virus, that this virus caused a pandemic. And yet, scientists in the field have been working on this for the last 10 years. There was an emerging pandemic threats program that was set up by the USAID and the U.S. government specifically to say, this is an issue, let's look at the data, and it's coming more, and the data shows it will be coming more and more frequently. So no one knew the extent of that it would be this much of a pandemic and it would be this bad. But yet we knew that there would be spillovers and outbreaks. And I think that the people working in the field and some of the scientists knew this, but it was difficulty getting that message out to the public. And I think that's a really good place for us to be looking at in general. How do we bridge the scientific knowledge and then sharing with the public to get really good, really solid information out? And I think it's an issue that we should be looking at communication. And again, every country has been doing it differently. It would be really great if there was a way to really work on a standardized communication plan to connect information coming in from the field, from the scientists. A lot of the work that we're doing does get posted on open access information so people can like health map places, information platforms where people can get information. But I think that we do need something a little bit more robust to translate that data coming in to the layperson, to the average person who's got questions. So I do think this is a gap that needs to get addressed. And I thank the questioner for having brought this up. And then my other suggestion was if we develop and if it's possible to develop an overarching organization with a multidisciplinary team that includes everything, the people working on the front line, gathering the data, the people, the platforms that analyze the data, and then the platforms or the organizations through which the data is communicated to the public, that would be really helpful because there was such confusion when there didn't really need to be.
Indeed. Thank you so very much, Dr. Murray. Maybe then to the second part of the question, Jean, with regard to investment, because that's at the core of your topic, technology to prevent the spread of the virus. What would you think about this?
Yeah, no, great questions. I was going to say that I was getting lots of good information during the virus about, you know, taking hydroxychloroquine and, you know, whether or not to ingest bleach. But anyway, I think the information spread between the virus is definitely a good question. I think too much of the information got politicized, and that's why you're confused. I don't know why you're trying to raise investment on something that you think can reduce the prevention of the virus. I mean, it feels like there's lots of businesses that would buy that today. The question on technology is always going to be, you know, does it deliver? Is it, you know, does it deliver what it's supposed to deliver? You know, and is it usable and how usable? And then it will come down to cost. But I think, you know, a multitude of those businesses are probably looking for solutions. So if it was me and I was, you know, I had access to a technology that, you know, could significantly reduce the risk of spread of virus within places of congregation, i.e. places of people of high density, then I'd probably be out there trying to sell it to all the companies that are pretty dislocated in the stock market, ranging from airlines to hotels to everybody else who'd probably be interested in your solution. On the point of the vaccine, I think, you know, a vaccine is part of the solution. I think if it comes to what I think is going to be coming first or ahead of the vaccine is a better understanding of how we can treat patients who are infected so that we have greater success in getting people through severity of disease and out the other end. I think is going to become something that should be something that I think comes first, which is really treatment protocols that have maximum efficacy and reduce the mortality rate or the case fatality rate with COVID. I think that probably may be something that comes ahead of the vaccine, given, you know, maybe this is back to you, Susan. I don't know what comes first, but I feel it's going to be treatment, you know, better treatments first, then vaccine, and, you know, probably alongside better treatments before that, if you can reduce people getting infected without having to shut down entire countries and economies, and go and sell that solution.
Great. I hope this answered your questions. In any case, should you have follow-up questions or more questions for us, please contact your client advisor and submit these questions to us so that we can basically publish them after this call. So this leads me actually to the end of this call, and thank you very much, Dr. Murray, Jean Némé, and Lachlan Toward, for your time and fascinating insights today. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your interest. COVID-19 is a wake-up call for all of us, illustrating the linkages between sustainability, the economy, and financial markets. As society recovers and we rebuild better than before, it is a good time to think about how your investment can do well and contribute to building a more resilient world. We would like to invite you to our next call of the Sustainable Future series, which will take place on the 10th of June and will focus on the topic of the future of energy. On behalf of my colleagues here at UBS, I'm wishing you all a good day. Please stay healthy and well. Goodbye.